between you and Kwame, anyone who has understanding about languages, I say hi. Dr. Ingrid Mattson was born in Canada, where she accepted Islam more than 16 years ago. Since embracing the Islamic religion, Dr. Mattson has visited several Muslim countries, including Egypt, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Iraq. She now serves as director of Islamic Chaplaincy and professor at the McDonald Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations at the Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. She lives in Connecticut with her husband and two children. She also serves as associate editor of the Muslim World and is fluent in classical Arabic. Dr. Mattson studied philosophy and fine arts at the University of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, earning her bachelor's degree in 1987. She earned her doctorate in Islamic studies from the University of Chicago in 1999. In 2001, Dr. Mattson was elected Vice President of the Islamic Society of North America. Her research is focused on Islamic law and society. Among many articles she authored, ethical authors are articles about studies on slavery, poverty, and Islamic legal theory. Dr. Mattson holds membership in the Middle East Studies Association and the American Academy of Religion. Some of the articles she authored and co-authored were, many of those were published in well-renowned papers, and she obtained also many numerous awards and fellowships, such as the Migrants America Scholarship and the University of Chicago Century Scholarship. Some of those articles' titles were How Muslims Use Islamic Paradigms to Define America in Becoming American, Immigration and Religious Life in the United States, Concepts of Poverty and Charity in Islamic Societies, Forgiveness and Enemies in the Quran, and many other articles as well. Tonight, she will give us her scholarly perspective on Islamic law in the modern world. Let us all welcome what I would describe as the gentle, grave, scholarly Western Muslim woman. Please.
For that introduction. Good evening to everyone. Peace be upon you. Assalamu alaikum. I'd like to first thank a few people, including Father Chris, with whom I had many emails to correspond as we got ready for this event. I'd like to thank President Sullivan, with whom I had dinner, for attending tonight and for hosting this event at the College of St. Rose. And Reverend Jim Payne for publishing me in The Evangelist. I'm published in this month's Evangelist, so look for that article on Islamic law. This subject that I'm speaking about, Islamic law, was chosen by us quite some time ago, before current events overtook us. You may think that a more topical event would have something to do with war and terrorism and all of these other kind of nasty things that are going on and surrounding us these days, but I still think that it is relevant and significant to talk about Islamic law, because many of the problems that we face today, I believe, arise from the notion that Muslims, their culture, their worldview, their way of life, their outlook is inevitably and completely at odds with what's called Western civilization, or Western thought and belief. That misunderstanding is the root of many of our problems, mutual problems. We are not two races of people come from two different planets. We are not, you know, Venus and Mars. We are all human beings living on this earth who have had a very complex but interactive history. You know, Muslims are not new to Western civilization. They're not new to America. If we just look at the United States, Muslims were among the earliest people who came to North America after the Native Americans. Muslims were with the very first explorers, with Christopher Columbus. In fact, they were trying to escape the Inquisition and thought it would be handy and maybe helpful to jump on the boat, cross the ocean, and find a new place to come. There are historical records that document that, the presence of Muslims with those early explorations. Muslims were here in large numbers among the Africans who were carried to the Americas as slaves. They tried to practice their religion in this continent, and they were denied that right. There are very good academic studies that document that. Now I would direct you to Sylvain Diouf's book, Servants of Allah, African Muslims Enslaved in the Americas, which is a very tragic documentation of the attempts of African Muslims to retain their religious practices and outlook, but that it was beaten out of them and denied to them. After that, there have been Muslims who came as immigrants for over 100 years. A few weeks ago, I was in Ohio and I met a woman whose great-grandfather came from Syria at the beginning of the 20th century, around 1900, and now her daughter is a fourth-generation Syrian-American. So Muslims have been here for a long time, and that's just the history, a short, very short history of Muslims in America. Historians are also increasingly showing that Europe was not unaware of Muslim presence. In fact, intellectually, culturally, economically, there were interactions between the Muslim world and Christian Europe much earlier than previously we thought, and that the kind of absolutes that the absolutist terms that we speak in fact, are not historically accurate. That's not the subject of my talk tonight, but it is an important introduction because one of the biggest challenges in speaking about any topic that deals with Islam is first uncovering the hidden or unconscious assumptions that many people have about Islam. You know, often if you ask a person, what do you know about Islam, about Islamic faith, culture, religion, many people will say, well, I don't really know anything. But then if you do a kind of word association, you'll find all sorts of negative associations. And assumptions about Islam and about Muslims, so that questions like the very questions that people ask, why do Muslims oppress women? Is Islam compatible with democracy? Speaks volumes to the kind of assumptions and stereotypes that many Americans have about Islam. And we can talk a little bit more about some of those issues in our discussion period. We should have lots of time for questions and answers at the end. And I invite you, you know, to formulate whatever question is on your mind tonight, because we won't be able to answer all of these questions in the talk. So tonight what I wanted to speak about really and focus on is Islamic law. Now, many of you have probably heard the term Sharia. And I should do just a kind of word association, but you would be embarrassed, so I'm not going to make you do it. If we had a silent ballot, I would say, how many of you have a negative association with the term Sharia or with Islamic law? And I would guess that a lot of you do. And that if I asked you what you thought it meant, what Sharia meant, I think that many of you would say it means harsh criminal punishment. And in fact, that's not accurate. But there is a reason why you think that, and I will get to that near the end of my talk. Let me begin by telling you what this term means. The term Sharia is an Arabic term that has a literal meaning before its technical meaning that encompasses Islamic law. The literal meaning is that it is a path towards the pool of water, or the watering hole. As you know, if you go out into the desert or into a rural place, there will be a place, a watering hole, where all the animals will come to, where people will come to, where everyone will go to get their source of water. And Sharia literally means the way to that source of life and sustenance. And so Sharia is in fact a methodology, an approach, an outlook, and a desire to try to get something of that divine life-giving sustenance. And that is the will of God, God's commands for us as we live on this earth. For a Muslim, the source of that, the most important sources of that life-giving source from the divine are the Quran, the holy scripture of Muslims, and the example of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, Muslims also look to other prophets as examples, and the stories of Abraham and Moses. Jesus is considered prophet in Islam. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is elevated in the Quran as a fine model for all Muslims to follow. Hagar, the wife of Abraham, is an exemplary figure in the Quran. And in fact, when Muslims go and make the pilgrimage, it is one of the pivotal rites of the pilgrimage in Mecca is a reenactment of this woman's search for water for her child. So Muslims imitate this pious woman in her behavior. So there are many, many models for Muslims that have come from God throughout the ages. But the most important sources are the Quran and the example of the Prophet Muhammad. Because we have a lot of information on the Prophet Muhammad, and Muslims believe that he was sent to give a kind of comprehensive outlook that would stay and last with people because he lived in history, many followers who documented his actions and his guidance. So what's important to understand is that Islamic law is an attempt to derive a way of life, an ethic, a morality, a holistic approach to interacting with other human beings in this life based on those sources. So the source of the Quran, which is a distinct book in Arabic, and then the example of the Prophet Muhammad, which is collected in many different books. You may have heard the term hadith, which means report. So many books of reports about the Prophet Muhammad and how he acted. But it's important to understand that these two sources, the Quran and then the collections of hadith, are not in themselves law books. These are sources of law. So that no person, neither Muslim nor non-Muslim or a person of other faith, can open these books, find a verse or find a statement and say, well, this is the law. This is what Muslims must believe to apply in certain situations. In fact, law has to be derived from these sources by qualified scholars. In Sunni Islam, Sunni Muslims are about 85% Muslims in the world. Shiites form about 10 to 15%. In both of the traditions, in fact, there's no ordination There's no defined clergy, although among Shiites, the scholars form more of a clerical kind of class of scholars than among Sunni Muslims. But in any case, scholarship is done by people who are qualified because of their knowledge and because of their piety. Now, of course, there are traditional ways by which people earn some recognition for their scholarship, just as in America we have universities and we have certificates and degrees. Similarly, the Muslim world developed a kind of certification process. In fact, as George McPhee at the University of Pennsylvania has documented in his book, The Rise of Colleges, the Muslim system of certification for your college's curriculum was most likely the model used in early Renaissance Europe for the formation of colleges based on endowments. This is an interesting, one of those interesting historical links that I urge you to search out and look at further. But my point here is about authority for interpretation. And this is a crucial issue, and it's one that Muslims in the present day need to explore even more carefully, because anyone can claim authority. Anyone can claim that they have the right opinion, the right interpretation. But the question is, when will they have other people recognize that claim? When will others acknowledge that that person, that scholar, that charismatic figure has some authority and give weight to their words and follow their opinion? And that is a very complicated story. It's a very complicated process, and there are so many factors involved in that, political and economic and institutional. And for Muslims in America, it's very important that we create systems that allow Muslims to have an open process of interpretation, at the same time not allowing the kind of chaos that permits any charismatic and emotional person to kind of draw in those young people or those people who, young Muslims who don't have as much knowledge, into their interpretation and their direction. So one of the things that we see when we examine Islamic history is that the scholars formed a kind of loose community, a loose interpretive community. They created among themselves schools of thought, means that provided some kind of uniformity, yet at the same time there was a great diversity that was permitted and a real pluralism in the law, so that scholars respected those of other schools, and they would say things like, I believe that I'm right, but I know you could be wrong. You could be right, but I could be wrong, but I think I'm correct. And they also believe that as long as someone, there's a statement of the Prophet Muhammad, that as long as someone who's qualified to interpret the law really makes an effort, really struggles and strives to find the right solution, they will get a reward with God. Now, if they're correct, they will get two rewards, which means that even if they arrive at the wrong solution, it is the effort and the struggle to engage in that attempt to discover the divine will that itself is part of the wisdom of God revealing his will through history to the prophets, to the messengers, and these sources. That there's something good in the process of discussion and debate and scholarship itself that will bring rewards with God. Of course, it's better if you get the right answer. You get those two rewards, but you still are rewarded for the effort. And that's something that allowed for a lot of pluralism in the legal process. It meant that orthodoxy was not a very strong concept in Islamic law and theology, that there weren't codes and creeds. Islamic law was never codified until the contemporary period because the imperative for Muslims throughout history was to continue to engage these divine texts with changing reality of society. And custom itself, local customs, were considered to be essential to the application of law. So that as long as a custom did not explicitly contradict something in the divine text, it could be incorporated into the law, which is one of the reasons why some scholars, including Lawrence Rosen at Princeton, classifies Islamic law as a common law system, because it does support local practice so much. At the same time, I think we shouldn't squeeze Islamic law into that, you know, European paradigm, because certainly it is a law that at the basis is aiming to seek the divine pleasure of God. But this idea of custom is very important because it's why we see, when we travel across the Muslim world, we see that there is great diversity in the practices of Muslims, in their houses of worship. The architecture looks different, the styles of dress. Yet at the same time, there's an underlying ethic. There's some principles that unite them. So that, for example, if we look at something that I know I'm going to get a million questions about, let's say dress, how Muslims dress, modest dress, we see that the principle of modest dress is universal across the Muslim world. Yet how that is lived out is very different in different cultures. If you go to West Africa, you see that the traditional dress of men and women are wide, broad, long flowing gowns and a turban. If you go to Pakistan, the traditional modest dress of men and women is the baggy pants and a long shirt, shawat kameez. If you go to Malaysia or Indonesia, the traditional modest dress of men and women is the wraparound skirt and then a long shirt and some kind of head covering. And as you have heard me say, men and women, that in most of these cultures, the men and women dress very similarly, but like in our culture, the men's dress and the women's dress is a little bit different in terms of the colors they wear, the textures, the cut of the garment will be a little bit different, but it's very similar. And similarly, in the United States, you'll get a lot of diversity, just as there's a lot of diversity among Americans in general in the way that they dress. So that you have an underlying principle, an underlying rule, which is a certain kind of modesty, yet it's that principle is adaptable to climate, to culture, to what kind of materials are available in a certain area. Now, where local custom is in contradiction with the Sharia, it's not permitted. One example of that is honor killings. Now, many people think that when they hear about honor killings, that in fact is part of Islamic law. That Muslims, engage in honor killings because this is something that's mandated by Islam. In fact, if we look at as early as 12th or 14th century legal text from Syria, which is the greater Syria, which includes Palestine, Jordan, we see that scholars at that time were talking about this practice because this was a practice among tribal people in the area. And in fact, in Jordan and Syria, just last year actually, Jordan outlawed this honor killings. But the concept of honor killing, meaning that a male can, that if a man kills a female relative because he claims that she had committed, brought shame to the family through sexual indiscretion, that his punishment would be mitigated. So he would get off with a much lighter punishment than manslaughter, that those laws were added to the books in Jordan and Syria as part of tribal law. Because those countries included legal, as they, when they formed as nation states after independence, after the colonial period, They included a number of different elements from different legal systems into their legal code. One was French law, because the French had colonized the area. Another body of law that they drew from was the Sharia, and then another body was tribal law. And this was a part of tribal practice and tribal custom. But it was something that was always rejected by Muslim scholars, and we see that, as I say, in medieval works of scholars, Syrian scholars at that time. And some of those works have been translated into English recently by scholars, including Judith Tucker, and there's another one, I'll remember it later. So that is something that was rejected. The scholars said that this practice is illegal and that there is no excuse for, this is simply murder, and that these people need to be punished. On the other hand, an area of local custom or an aspect of local custom that could be included into the law would be something like alimony. So that when there is a alimony and maintenance, so that when a man divorces his wife and needs to support her for a certain period according to Islamic law, or when a man needs to provide alimony payments to his ex-wife who has custody of the children, that the level of that support will be determined according to custom. You know, what is the lifestyle that those people are used to? You can't argue that a family living in America should be supported according to the standards that are, you know, applied in a village in Pakistan. Because in a village in Pakistan, no one has a car. In Albany, you know, in New York State, most people have cars. They need cars. They need all sorts of other, or they're used to, at least accustomed to, all sorts of other things in life that to make their lives more comfortable and livable and progressive. So that's something that Islamic law always recognized, that there are certain aspects of custom that necessarily have to be included in Islamic law as long as they don't contradict the Sharia. And because of that, it's a very flexible, the Sharia always is a very flexible approach to law, and it's why it existed as the legal system for 1300 years across much of Africa and Asia and Eastern Europe for the Muslim communities there. It wasn't until colonialism that this system was broken up, taken over, deconstructed, and we are left with a lot of negative consequences of that until today. Before I talk a little bit more about the negative consequences of the dismantling of the Sharia under the colonial regime, let me address another issue that is often misunderstood. It's a kind of truism that there's no separation between church and state in Islam. And you'll find even Muslims say that, and they say it with pride in a way that the Sharia is integrated, so that Muslims don't have one set of values for their personal life and then another set of values for politics, for example. That we should apply the same morality, the same ethics to our personal life as to our business life and our political life. That's absolutely true, but that doesn't mean that there are no limits on the jurisdiction of the state. Because when we talk about separation of church and state, this is really what we're talking about. To what extent can the state enforce a certain religion or faith tradition or practices? Now, classically, in pre-modern times, I'm not going to say that there was a separation of church and state like we have in America. That would be just untrue. However, the relationship was not as close as some people would imagine. In fact, one of the things that these legal scholars did and were concerned about from a very early period was maintaining some independence from the state. And we see that from the very earliest period of Islam, that those scholars who were engaged in interpreting the law and expounding upon the law were very concerned that the state would not use this law as justification for whatever political policy they had. For that reason, they were very reluctant to serve in government, and they also were eager to have an independent economic basis so that they could have their own institutions. And that's why from a very early period they established endowments for students to study the law, for scholars, so that they could interpret and teach the law without government stipends, and ultimately to establish institutions, seminaries, where they could teach the law. And these seminaries and law colleges were independent of the government. That way, the law could be interpreted and understood and studied out of the direct control of the government. Now, of course, when the state needed judges, they would turn to the graduates of these seminaries to appoint them into the court. Yet, it was only, they could never appoint someone as a judge, as a qadi, the Arabic word is qadi, unless they'd gone through a system that really was controlled by the scholars themselves. And that was very important for allowing some separation between religious and legal scholarship and the state. And one of the things that the scholars did was that they classified every regulation in a certain way, that an action could be obligatory or it could be simply recommended or neutral. It could be a prohibited action or it could be only discouraged. And the state was limited in its jurisdiction by this categorization, so that the state couldn't get involved in all of the areas of life if they weren't something that was clearly in their jurisdiction. Similarly, even in those areas of life that were considered obligatory for a Muslim, for example, acts of worship, that the realm of acts of worship really was not a major concern of the state. Now, of course, the state supported religious practice and religious institutions so that they made sure that the roads were clear for people to go for pilgrimages, and they would even patronize, you know, hotels along the way. So they would encourage and support religious practice. Yet, there was a great diversity because of the different legal schools and law schools. There was diversity in the way that many of these rituals were practiced. And the state did not get involved in enforcing one over the other. So there was nothing like the Council of Nicaea, for example, that insisted a particular theology or practice was enforced. In fact, it was up to the scholars to decide what would be the practice and interpretation in their area, and the state would take a step back from that. Now, that was really important because that allowed a kind of de facto separation between church and state. You also had a very strong notion of public space and private space. And the scholars, one way that the scholars ensured that this hegemony of the state was limited was by drawing a line between public and private space. And so that even things that were prohibited, unless they were apparent in the street, it wasn't the business of anyone to go probing for those actions. So, for example, drinking alcohol is prohibited to Muslims. Yet, the scholars said, look, you know, you cannot, the state has no right, and even a neighbor or you know, someone who lives by has no right to peep in the keyhole, to look in the window, to overhear what's going on next door. Whatever people do in their house is between them and God. It only becomes a common concern if it ends up in the street and disturbing the public order. Then the state can say something about it. So this was a kind of, it's a very different idea of tolerance than what we're used to. Because sometimes what we, in the common or contemporary usage, we think of tolerance as saying that everything's okay. You know, you do what you do and I do what I do and I can't judge that your action is right or wrong. This is a different idea of tolerance. This is a tolerance that says, I believe that something's wrong, but I don't have any right to invade your space if you're doing things that I don't approve of. So it's a different idea, yet for pre-modern times, it really was quite progressive compared to many other societies, and it allowed for quite a bit of freedom, personal freedom, in addition to the freedom of communities to really form lifestyles and ways that were quite diverse. This included non-Muslim communities, so that Christians and Jews were given jurisdiction over their own affairs in many, many aspects of life. Family law, including things like marriage, divorce, inheritance, and many other matters, were left within the jurisdiction of those communities. They had their own leaders, they had their own arbitrators, they had their own judges, and they would be able to decide their affairs accordingly. Now, a lot of those protections, let me say, that were built into Islamic law, protections to keep the state out of the life of daily life of ordinary people, to allow diversity of practice and thought, a lot of those positive things were lost in the late pre-modern and the modern period for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is, as I've mentioned before, colonialism. Now, one of the first things that the colonialists did when they came to different areas of the Muslim world in Asia and Africa, in addition to non-Muslim areas, I mean, let's just say colonialism in general, but the same kind of techniques were used, but in the particular case of Muslim societies, because endowments were so important, and they were such an important aspect of what we would call civil society, which is an important counterweight to the state, what those colonial powers did was close down all the endowments. They either closed them down or they brought them all under each control of the central state and the government, which means that the independence was lost. And that's why when people talk now about civil society and Islam or civil society in Muslim countries, they say, well, why isn't there any civil society? The reason why there isn't any civil society is because it was all closed down. And we can't only blame the British and the French and the Dutch, although they started it, but we can blame the regimes that came after. Because unfortunately, when the Muslim world was given independence from colonialism, it was given independence only in the way that the colonial powers wanted them to be independent, which was that these states would be nation states, that would be split up according to borders that the colonial powers thought were the most beneficial to their own interests, and that the individuals who were allowed to take control were those who would also be seen as having some kind of interest in furthering a relationship with the former colonial powers. Now, sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't. Sometimes someone who was made the leader was overthrown in a military coup, and some other leader came up who was very hostile to the former colonial powers or Western powers or European powers. But what happened was that they inherited a certain state structure that was alien to Islam. It was a new kind of identity. It was the identity of the nation state, and it was a new kind of government. It was a government that now was very centralized and that was concerned about creating a modern citizen, a kind of homogeneous citizen of this nation state. Now, how was that achieved? There have been many studies of the post-colonial world about how education, public education, was used to create the model citizen. So whereas previously local communities would have their little schools and there would be a lot of diversity in education, now the central government designed a curriculum and printed textbooks and distributed them to the villages to make these people fit the model of a citizen. Similarly, these legal and religious institutions came under the central authority of the state. And now, these religious institutions and the legal system was very politicized in a new way. And what you would have would be these institutions were used to further the conception of this new state, the identity of the state. So that if it was if this state decided to identify itself as modern, then a certain kind of uniform was instigated into the schools, and everyone had to wear a kind of uniform. All the children, previously they would be wearing their local dress and colorful and this thing. Now they had to look a certain way. Everyone in the country wore a certain kind of dress that reflected what the values of that state were. And there was a big ideological battle. In a place like Turkey, the Ataturk, the ruler of Turkey, decided we're going to throw off all of our heritage and put our future with Europe. And so now any traditional dress is illegal. It was illegal to wear a turban in public. It was illegal for women to wear the traditional dress or veil in public. Illegal. I mean, it wasn't just encouraged. It was actively, people were persecuted for wearing this. You know, veils were ripped off and turbans were pulled off and all this kind of thing. I mean, the intrusiveness, you can see the intrusiveness of the state. There's a new way of relating, of the state relating to people, and there aren't these independent institutions anymore to feed in. Now, if you've been subject to that for a certain amount of time, if you take control of the government, what are you going to do? You can use the same techniques. So we have the great irony of places like Afghanistan. In Afghanistan in 1950, the king of Afghanistan, he went and he visited Europe. And he was very impressed with it. So he came home and he said, that's it, we're going to be modern. And being modern means wearing a suit and a tie and a hat. So that he said that anyone who comes into Kabul has to wear a modern dress. Now you have a country of 99% farmers, and when they come into Kabul, they have to wear this kind of dress. So what happened? Well, being a very innovative people, booths, rental booths, popped up all around the outskirts of Kabul, so that the peasants and the farmers, when they had to come into the city to buy something, to go to the market, to go to a government building to get some paper or some form, they had to come in and change out of their baggy, loose, modest, flowing clothes and wear this suit and a tie and a hat. And to them, it was very immodest. These clothes compared to what they were used to. It was as if we were told when we went to file our taxes at the federal building that we had to put on, tank top and shorts or something before we could enter the building. I mean, it just was really invasive. So guess what? When you have a group like the Taliban taking power, what do? They do the other thing. They have different kind of dress code that they impose, but what they've learned about the proper role of government is to put a uniform on their citizens. And this is not the traditional way. The traditional way is that people don't wear a uniform that the state distributes to them. So that we're still, living with a lot of the consequences of these political systems that were brought to the Muslim world. But it's definitely time that we got over it. And I think that we see that in some areas. In a place like Iran, if you talk to people who have been living there since 1979, they will tell you that there have been huge changes and that what began as a very ideological movement, very controlling and homogenizing and uniform, now has relaxed, and that people realize that the proper role of religion is not to impose a kind of uniform on people, whether it's a literal uniform in terms of a dress or even in a mindset, but to create a kind of atmosphere where people can access their God-given freedom to live a good life, if that's what they choose. Unfortunately, what happens in the particular case of Iran is that there are, you know, those old-timers who are invested in keeping that old system, and they're fighting very hard against the kind of changes that many even of the original scholars of the revolution have now rethought. So it's an interesting situation, and I had a lot of optimism about the country until a couple of weeks ago, because I'm just wondering with the current situation, if there might not be a kind of backtracking on some of the progress that's been made in that country. Let me say that I want lots of time for questions, so I don't want to go too long, but there are a few things I need to say. Let me also say that politicians in any country, in any society, will try to use whatever the normative discourse is around them to justify their actions. So that when you see a political ruler in a Muslim country justifying his actions in the name of Islam, that doesn't necessarily mean that the people believe that this person is religious or that this person is in fact exhibiting the best characteristics of the religion, just as we as Americans can often be very cynical when our politicians refer to their beliefs or their morals or whatever. We know that sometimes, all too often, people in power in politics will use religion to try to gain support. And that's true in Muslim countries, so that we have the situation where dictators or corrupt politicians will try to use Islam to garner support from the people. I was saying at dinner that I remember in the middle of the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein, after spending the previous 20 years suppressing and oppressing any religious leader who said anything against his oppressive regime, suddenly in the middle of the Gulf War, someone took a black magic marker and scrawled "God is great, Allahu Akbar" in the middle of the flag. It just appeared one day out of nowhere. Before it was just a bunch of stripes, and then suddenly this motto that God is great appeared in the middle of the flag. I mean, it was clearly just a cynical attempt to try to garner some support or some draw on the religious sentiment of the people. I don't think anyone was really that fooled by him, but it happens in, it happens in other countries. And one of the things that we find is that, like in this country, people can be made frightened by insecurity and instability. And sometimes in that situation, when people are feeling insecure and that there's a lot of crime in society, that a politician or a leader who appears tough on crime can get a lot of support. And that's what we see in a country like Nigeria. Nigeria is, according to some political scientists, the most corrupt country on earth. It is the degree of corruption in all levels of government in Nigeria is astounding. And at the same time, it is exceedingly unsafe. The streets are unsafe. Carjackings and robberies and break-ins into the home, all these things are just at skyrocketing levels. So that in that situation, you have a leader coming and saying, well, I'm going to get tough on crime, and they start taking a lot of poor people and executing them or giving them corporal punishments, unfortunately, some people think, yes, that's the solution. Let's just lock up the criminals. But as we know, even in our own situation here, maybe not as extreme, but sometimes, unfortunately, we do see a similar kind of harshness. That is not getting to the root of the problem. And it seems to me that more than anything, what we have to understand is that this is not the Sharia. Because as I said, Sharia is not a set of laws or a set of punishments. It is an approach, it is an attitude, it is a direction, a kind of methodology. And if someone is simply applying laws thoughtlessly from some medieval, you know, law book, that's not Sharia, that's just politics. And this can explain why inflexibility and harshness are considered laudable, whereas mercy, compassion, and the greater social good, in fact, are the essence of the law. And anyone who studied the books of Islamic law sees that these are the principles that continue to be stated and restated, that any time that there could be a negative consequence from the application of a law, that law shouldn't be applied. And this is a principle in Islamic law, that the law came to ease people's problems, not to create hardship. Unfortunately, this is something that people learn naturally. I mean, the ordinary people know this, but scholars need to study it, and that's why there need to be institutions that have a kind of independence and that are not simply at the that are used by the state to further a particular political agenda in order for it to work. Now, in conclusion, let me just say, why should we even bother thinking about Islamic law? You know, don't we just have the perfect legal system, and why don't we just apply it everywhere in the world, and then we won't have any problems? Well, let me say there's a few reasons. First of all, any legal system to be successful has to be integrated into the culture, customs, and morality of the people of that society. Law supports morality and custom and culture, and it cannot be imposed as a superficial device over top. And there are things that work very well in one society that do not in the other one. If we look at something like neighbors, the idea of neighbors. Now, there's a common saying in our culture, fences make good neighbors. So the idea that the way you have you retain a harmonious relationship with your neighbor is to make sure that you know your limits and your bounds. There's an Arabic saying about neighbors, and that's ajab qabla dab. That means choose your neighbor before you choose your house. It's a totally opposite meaning. It's that the most important thing is to find a good neighbor whose company you can enjoy and you can get along with. And in fact, Islamic law recognizes the neighbor to have a right. In fact, to the point that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that I almost gave rights to the neighbor in inheritance. But they have legal rights on their neighbor. If my neighbor does not have enough food for him or herself and their children, they have a right to come to my house and ask for food, and I legally have to give it to them. It's my obligation, my legal obligation, not just moral. And there's a whole, when you look across the Muslim world, you see there's a whole ethic that goes along with that. When I worked in a refugee camp, an Afghan refugee camp, for over a year in northern Pakistan, I always constantly saw families who were living in tents, who had only bread, rip off some of that bread and give it to the neighbor who had nothing. Even though they didn't have enough for themselves, but they thought that it was immoral for them to eat something when their neighbor had nothing. So there's a wisdom in this law, there's a beauty in this law that is reflected in the behavior of the people, and that they should be able to to have a legal system that reflects their worldviews, their beliefs, but it needs to be a legal system that takes into account the realities of the contemporary world. So you can't apply the medieval classical legal tradition to the contemporary world, which is very different. In fact, that wouldn't even be living up to the spirit of Islamic law, because Islamic law always took into account the culture and changing situations of people. Unfortunately, that's something that many people don't realize. The other point about the reason why we should at least explore this issue of Islamic law is that for other people, it's not only of benefit for Muslims. It can give some insight and some perspective to non-Muslims. Not that they will want to embrace it as their legal tradition, but perhaps it can give them some insight into public policy issues. For example, if we look at the tension between balancing the need to reward individual achievement with recognizing that each of us has reached our potential only through the support and help of others, then we can see some concepts in Islamic law that help balance that tension. And what I mean by that is this idea that, you know, we have in society of the self-made person, you know, I achieve this goal by myself. Well, we know that that's a fallacy. We know that every single person in this room has only reached this position in their life because of the nurturing and support and care and sustenance of so many people, from the family members who fed them and clothed them and taught them, even the articulation, the ABC of our speech. We could never have done that by ourselves. The doctors, the farmers, all those people who made us what we are. So none of us are self-made people. And for that reason, Islamic law strikes a balance between in terms of wealth and distribution of wealth. Islamic law recognizes the right of people to possess wealth, to accumulate wealth, but at the same time, we have certain obligations to other people, and they have rights in our wealth. So for example, when a Muslim dies, when they write their will, they cannot disinherit their family. It's not permitted in Islamic law. There are family members who have an absolute right in your wealth. Because whether you're arguing with them or not, whether you like them or not, they're family and they have something to do with making you who you are. Similarly, the society around us. This is why 2.5% of the wealth of a Muslim must be paid annually to the poor and needy and to other charitable causes. The rest of the money, take it. Do with it what you want. Accumulate as much money as you want. But there are people who have a right in that wealth. Similarly, in our families, in American law, parents have an obligation to support and maintain their children. In Islamic law, that obligation extends to other relatives as well. Grown children have a legal obligation to support and maintain their parents if they're in need. That's an absolute obligation. They can't deny that. So that some of these ideas, the way that Islam has balanced some of these tensions that we find in society, can be helpful to other people. And it's by discussing these issues that we can come to perhaps some better public policy for all of society. To conclude, Muslim scholars throughout the world, not just in the United States, but Egypt, Malaysia, Pakistan, there are very smart and creative Muslim scholars who are dealing with the challenge of rethinking the Islamic law in the contemporary world, dealing with the challenge of pluralism, of the identity of a citizen in a secular state, so where religious identity is not now the primary identity like it was in the pre-modern period. How do we find a place for Islamic law while respecting the rights of people who profess a different faith or no faith at all to exercise their God-given freedom to go about their life? So there are people all over the world, Muslim scholars all over the world, who are writing about these things, who are thinking about these things. And in this country, one of the things that many Muslims are recognizing is that to apply Sharia, to apply Islamic law in America, is impossible for a Muslim without making alliances with people of other faiths. Now, what do I mean by that? If I take Sharia seriously, I know that in this law and in this outlook, that every human being in the Sharia, in fact, every animal even, has a right to sustenance, the kind of wholesome sustenance that can support him or her. Now that's part of the Sharia. How am I going to achieve that in this society? Even if I, work 24/7 in a soup kitchen, I can't really achieve that goal in our society. I'm going to have to work for laws that provide fair wages to people, that provide educational, social programs, and economic structure that allows human beings to be able to live a life of dignity in the kind of material comfort that is their right, no matter what their faith. Now, Muslims are, 6-7 million in America. We can't achieve that goal by ourselves. So if I take the my desire to implement Sharia seriously, it means that I can only do that hand in hand and in alliance with other people of goodwill who want to achieve the same goal. So part of this whole process of living up to the divine will, of following that path towards seeking God's pleasure, mean that I have to walk along with some people who aren't Muslim. And that is not just a necessity, but part of what God wants me to do. And there's wisdom in that as well. And that's one of the reasons why I'm happy to be here tonight with this group and to, applaud you for your efforts to know more about each other. And I hope that you do move, if you haven't already, from dialogue to more action. Because that is really the next step and the important step that we all need to take to transform our world. Thank you very much.
Regards the process or methodology of interpretation. And most specifically, is the process or method strictly a linguistic or traditional sorts of using natural process of comparing language, or is there also inspirational and perhaps transcendental aspects to that interpretation?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly rational methods are used. But at the same time, our intellect is very limited, and you can always push the argument further. So when do you know when to stop? This is where you have to have that, cultivate the relationship with God and ask for God's guidance to give you insight into the questions. Where should you be looking? To ask God to not let you remain in a mistake, to give you some kind of indication that you may have overlooked something or you may have done something wrong. And when we read the biographies of great scholars, we find that very often they may have made a judgment or come to a position and then found themselves sleepless or had a dream or some other indication that because of their closeness to God, that made them feel that they should return to the books or return to their methodology and look a little bit deeper.
Yeah. I have a follow-up just to discuss the flexibility, the pluralism interpretation that said that there should be not charismatic leaders who could be corrupt And yet we know that there are always corrupt, charismatic people in the world. I do agree that laws have to follow the culture, so the merit system isn't right for everybody. But in the merit system, we have the flexibility, the pluralism. But what we have is a methodology to the checks and balances to counter those people who get off the track. And now you talk about how far rationalism will go, but isn't that then going into the charismatic, or where are the checks and balances? How do you discourage the self-imposed dictator and the self-imposed God?
Well, this is what I was saying about the need for, this is why in the classical system, institutions were created in order to provide some kind of checks and balance, so that there was a system of licensing scholars, there were curriculum that people had to go through, and all of these things made sure that they provided a balance to the claims of other people. Now you can't, as you say, there will always be individuals outside of the system who will make claims, who can be charismatic, who can draw people to them. But you have to have a system. I mean, that's the point. As long as you have a system, then it's clear to people that these are outside of the system, and even if certain people would get attracted to them for a time, that that the weight of the system, the existing legal system and structure, would be enough to counteract any particular emotional influence this person has. And in fact, this is what the assigned legal system had for a long, long time, until it was systematically dismantled under colonialism. And these institutions, these colleges, these systems and processes of giving certification and diplomas to scholars was dismantled.
What do you see for the future in order to control these problems?
Well, it depends where we're talking about. I mean, if we're talking about the Muslim world in general, every country has different problems. Some of the problems in some countries are because there is a non-democratic or, government that's very hegemonic and controlling. In that case, they obviously need the system to be freed up, so that people can develop these institutions, so that there can be a separation of powers.
Yes, my name is Father Gayles, pastor of St. Anne Maronite Church in Florida. Before I pose my question, I would like to clarify an issue that was put in the flyer being sent to everybody here, I believe. You mentioned that you visited many Muslim countries, including Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon. I would clarify that Lebanon is not a Muslim country.
Yeah, I didn't write that.
Well, the flyer is testimony to that. Just clarification.
Yeah. Well, I believe what they meant is countries where there are a lot of Muslims.
There is Muslims in Lebanon, but it's not a Muslim country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some people would say Jordan isn't a Muslim country either.
It's
a kingdom.
Well, there's facts about that. The question is, you mentioned some misunderstanding about Islam, that the world really confused and can't understand what Islam in itself is. When someone reads the Holy Quran, as a Christian, and see what the dramatic dogmas in the Quran about other religions. When someone reads, and we are in a Catholic university here, someone reads in the Quran, and I would say for you that's the book of the table, Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse 37, where he says, anybody who believes that Jesus, or the Christ, the son of Isa, Isa, the son of Mary, is the Son of God. He is blaspheming, and he deserves the fire of hell. And anybody who believes that God is free also deserves the same thing. And they are blasphemers, and they deserve the fire of hell. And it goes to verse 55, and that the fire of God are those who execute that, and that they are the victors. Regarding that. This is the first question. How do you interpret that?
Sorry, what is the question?
The question is misunderstanding. What misunderstanding is there for someone reading? That's the source of the Sharia. This is the source of the Sharia.
Are you asking me, or are you...
I'm asking you.
Would you like me to respond?
Yes, I will finish my question, the second part.
Well, why don't I respond to this question first?
If you let me complete my question, and I'll sit down, if you don't mind.
Because let me finish this question first, because it's... What you're doing is... this is a fundamentalist interpretation of the Quran, but it's not a Muslim fundamentalist, it's a Christian Islamic fundamentalist interpretation of the Quran. This is what I say about taking a verse out of context and saying that this is law. What you've done is quote, in fact, a translation, first of all, a translation in your own, or a paraphrase of a translation, of the Quran and not the original Arabic, first of all. And then you're saying what that means. Now, whether you say, what that means, is that what God means, is that what Muslim scholars mean, is another question. Now, with respect, what I was saying was not that people misunderstand Islam. I was talking about Sharia. What does the Sharia say about the position of Christians? Certainly, the Sharia says, taking into account all of the verses of the Quran, including probably some that you're aware of that talk very highly about Christians and pious Christians, and that including monks and priests and other people, that it is, in fact, a blasphemy to say that God has a son. That is absolutely the assigned position, that Muslims believe that God is one. That does not mean that Christians do not have a right to that belief. Christians continue to have a right to have that belief, and the reason why there are Christians in Lebanon, still until this day, is that under Islamic law, they were given the right to preach that doctrine. Many different Christian churches, not only Maronites, but Eastern Orthodox, Syrian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox, the Coptic Church, for all of those years under Islamic rule, were allowed to preach various, their different doctrines on Christology freely to their people. And that's the most important thing. Tolerance is not that you and I will have the same view about God. You, as a Christian, whatever Christianity you practice, don't have the same belief about God as a Methodist minister, or as a Christian Scientist, or someone else. So you can believe that the Christian Scientist is wrong, but tolerance is allowing them to preach that and to teach that. And that really is what we need. And at the same time, the understanding of Muslim scholars about the Christian positions really depended on the interpretation of Christians themselves. So that as different Christian churches have a different understanding about the nature of Jesus and his relationship to God, then there's a different opinion about the relationship of Muslims to that standard.
In regard that first of all, Christianity in Lebanon never was under the Islamic rule to be permitted. Second, the history state of fact that they fought their way to practice liberation. That's first.
Thank
second,
you. I think, let me just say that there were about 20 people raising their hand, and we can continue. You know, maybe it would be more appropriate if there was a specific occasion to talk about the history of Christianity in the Middle East, because you're making factual claims that you and I can bring
I'd like to allow other people to ask questions as well, and I invite you to continue the conversation after the I think you've asked the question, and we spent a lot of time on your question, so I'd like you to ask it. Right?
Thank you. Okay, it's impossible not to talk about what's going on around with a lot of claims made by the Islam and modernity, some of them have been political propaganda, some of them have been things I say. I think one thing I've learned is that the divisions that we consider essential to modernity in the modern world, that have arisen in the West in a lot of areas, seem to have existed in Islam in ways that just are hard to comprehend, people here to comprehend, including people making up the modernity. And you talked about the centralization of the state, the secular state, which we assume was, you know, we say it's Islam that is finding this. And of course, the history of it, I believe, is that in the modern world, people have asked by democratic means for the Islamic society that they wanted repeatedly in many countries in the Middle East, and they have been thwarted by secular rule, some pro-Western, some anti-Western, but very often aided by the West. So the division that we consider modern seems to have existed in the context of religious life that seems to spark us to comprehend. So I wanted to ask you about two things and Sharia. You talked about this decentralization of civic life. I understand from my reading that there was a scientific flowering in the Islamic world in the 8th and 9th century in astronomy and medicine, geology, botany, and so forth, and math, that proved actually essential to the Renaissance, and the scientific enlightenment didn't arise many centuries later in the West, and it occurred in the context of a theological state, what we would consider a centralized state, under Sharia. And I know that the Jewish and Christian scholars participated fully. So that is a contradiction on one issue about the role of Sharia law. The second similar issue is religious freedom. We have this religious separation of church and state because there's been a history in the West of conflict between Jew and Christian, and between every branch of Christian has been a central part of the history of Europe for many centuries. And although in Islam there have been a lot of conflict among different branches of Islam, and I don't think that Islam is all that tolerant toward polytheistic or theistic or atheistic, there's been acceptance, as you pointed out, despite these verses in the Quran, how they interpreted, for Christians and Jews who have been out of the peace in the context of what we call a theocratic state for 15 centuries, and we can't comprehend that. Mm-hmm. So, we just think that's alien to be part of a church-run society. I want to ask you, what do you think the role of the church has been, and how it is different from our Western world?
Part of the reason why we may see that as contradictory is because we use our own European history as the paradigm. Just because there was a problem between science and faith in medieval Europe doesn't mean that there necessarily has to be that. The reason why scientific inquiry flourished in Muslim countries was because the Quran itself encourages human beings to look and study and observe nature as part of indication of God's presence, you know, the creation is a sign of the Creator, and that there aren't concepts in the Quran that contradict science. In fact, many of them support science and led Muslim scholars to look further and further. And even some aspects of ritual practice necessitated scientific inquiry. So, for example, Muslims have to face Mecca when they pray. Now, if you're anywhere out of visibility of the Kaaba in Mecca, you have to be able to find direction, which is one reason why Muslim scientists developed the astrolabe, or which is also called a star latch, in order to help determine direction. They studied astronomy and geography and all these things. Similarly with time, the timing of the prayers and calendar, many other things were required even by ritual law. So that's one thing. The second thing is, again, the idea that wine in a so-called theocratic state could Jewish communities and Muslim or Christian communities have their own religious law and family law administered by themselves. Again, because we're applying the paradigm of a sort of centralized hegemonic state, that simply wasn't the pre-modern reality of the state. The state, in fact, even among the Muslim communities, pushed so much of the power back to local communities. And this is why Lawrence Rosen talks about a sound law, a common law system, because the power goes back to communities, including to the communities of other faith traditions that also encompass Zoroastrians and even Hindus for a number of centuries, although at other times there were certain Muslim rulers who oppressed Hindus. So one of the things that we see in particular with tolerance and intolerance as a historian that I see is that wherever there's we see an increase in oppression by the state of the non-Muslim minorities, it's almost inevitably accompanied by oppression of the ordinary Muslim people as well. So it's part of a whole, state attitude. So if we look at, for example, the oppression of non-Muslim minorities in Iran since the Islamic Revolution, well, Muslim people also, who didn't toe the party line, even Muslims, Iranian Muslim scholars, who were part of the original ruling class, who changed their idea, or had a different idea from the proper role of, state and religion, were considered heretical and were thrown in prison also. So the, Baha'is and other people in Iran who were in prison had lots of Muslim Muslim companions in the prison. So to me, a lot of it has to do with simple abuse of state power, not separation of church and state, although the idea of identity is very important, because it's true that in the pre-modern Muslim world, individuals were identified as members of faith communities. Everyone was. You were grouped as a category of a faith community. Now, and during the time, that worked pretty well. It was a pretty good system, at least compared to what was happening in some other places, for example, in Europe. Now, in this century, that would not work very well. That system wouldn't work very well. So what has to be done is to go back and look at the principles of the Sharia and how to apply those principles in this different political context and structure.
As you said, there has been a decline in Islam in the last century or so, for economic and other reasons. What can Americans do, and especially Muslim Americans do, to bring back Islam to its former greatness?
Well, one of the wonderful things of being in the United States is that there is the freedom of inquiry and so many resources in the universities and other places that we find that Muslim scholars and activists are really utilizing the experiences they have in the United States and the education to rethink many of these positions, so that you have think tanks like the Center for Islam and Democracy in Virginia. You study for the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. You have the National Association of Muslim Lawyers, who work on the smaller legal issues in public policy. Involved in that group are Muslim lawyers who have also studied Islamic law, and they're trying to look at some of the gaps between the theory and the practice, or some places where the classical theory needs to be reapplied. You have Muslims who are in Islamic studies departments across North America who are writing papers, writing books. So it's an excellent place to be. These ideas are being carried to the Muslim world. But, we shouldn't think that, we shouldn't be so you know, centered here to believe that nothing is going on in other parts of the world. If you look in, academic journals in Egypt or in Jordan, Pakistan, Malaysia, there are very, interesting and well-researched and creative positions and ideas that are coming out of those places. The question is, will people have the political freedom to put those ideas into practice? And that's the big gap now. The big gap is between the ideas and the political system that keeps people from putting those ideas into practice.
One of the things that you often say is in terms of incorporating or modernizing the practice of Islam is to constantly go back to the Quran and the holy writings to see how they should evolve into daily practice in this country or wherever. Whereas the paradigm for most of us, for me, I won't say most of us, for me, is that the place to go back to in this country is the Constitution. That's not God-based, and it's not based on finding the divinity of God or making ourselves at one with God. It's based on a system of legal practice that helps to ensure individual rights and equal protection of the law, and a law that's not a God-based law, but a very secular-based law. So that seems to me that's like a fundamental division between a religion-based society, and it's not only Islam. The same thing is true. Israel has the same kinds of problems, I think.
Well, I don't think the divide is as clear as you make it, because, for example, the fact that Sharia is based on the Quran does not mean that it doesn't acknowledge the need for political structures. I mean, if you look at the most basic theological principle, which is that humans are created free to choose whatever belief they want, choose free even to reject God. God, from the Muslim theological position, God created people with freedom, human beings with freedom, even to reject him. Now that's a freedom that no one can take away, because it is God-given. So that it really, what I'm saying to you is that I'm not saying to go back just to the Quran, I'm saying go back to the principles of the Sharia that are induced and derived from the Quran and the Hadith and other things. And this is one of the principles. One of the principles is that human beings are created free. And from that position, you can get to, you can talk about a political structure, you conceive of a political structure that ensures freedom of religion. And that's a clear statement in the Quran. There's no compulsion in religion. That doesn't mean that Muslims believe that every belief is identically correct. We have our belief about God, and we think it's correct. You have your beliefs about God, or not, or whatever, and you think it's correct, but I cannot impose my belief system on you, and the political system should reflect it. Now, throughout Islamic history, has it always done that? No. Throughout American history, often our own principles have been, we haven't lived up to our principles. African Americans certainly know that, that they were not considered human beings in this country for centuries. So that not every, I'm not saying that Muslim societies have always lived up to their principles, but that we can find, what I'm saying is I don't believe there's necessarily an inherent contradiction. Because even with the American Constitution, there is a protection for religion. And even people in politics have a right to have their beliefs, and they have a right to advocate public policies based on their beliefs, but they don't have a right to force their beliefs on other people. And so to me, it's not it's not a secular system in the sense that religion is absent or religious belief is absent, but that the state can't impose one or favor one one faith over another.
And I'm going to preface this by saying I do have greatest respect for your religion, but how do you account for something like Wahhabism rising? I mean, their claim, as I understand it, is that they want to return your faith to as it was when it was first founded, and yet, from what I have studied, they are incorrect in many ways about doing that. But my question is, why haven't more Muslims in that part of the world caught on to that?
To being opposed to that.
Right.
He is talking about a certain tendency in interpretation among Muslims that's known as Wahhabism. So the Wahhabis, you know, who are characterized by the they don't call themselves Wahhabis, but what we could talk about, we can identify a few characteristics in their interpretation. One is that they tend towards absolutes. Like things are either absolutely prohibited or they're absolutely obligatory. And in that, they're very different from the traditional schools of law. In many other ways, they tend towards interpretations that are not in harmony with the traditional schools of Islamic law. And that's why their ideas have not spread widely except through publications that are easily distributed and widely available because of funding. But you have seen, I mean, throughout the Muslim world, a lot of resistance to a kind of narrowing and rigidity interpretation. You know, most Muslims do reject that as a valid interpretation of the law. But we have the same, you know, I mean, every society has the same problem. Literalism, people who interpret scripture very literally, who open the book and pull out a verse and say this is what it means. That happens everywhere, and scholars of religion, comparative religion, have identified a lot of underlying reasons why that occurs in different societies.
Your mention of Iran before reminded me of a news item from several months ago that said it pushed out of my consciousness by other news. About a professor in Iran who was arrested and sentenced to death for saying things that might approximate what you just said tonight. within the context of the presentation tonight, can you explain the process that led to this adjudication, by whose authority was this done? And I don't know what happened ultimately. Maybe you can help me with that.
I think he was, I believe he was released, or at least the death sentence was made into some lesser punishment. I don't know exactly where he is now, if he's still in prison or not. But the main problem in Iran is that, as I indicated before, you have this ideological state. You have a state that identifies itself with a certain ideology and believes that its role is to, you know, impose that uniform ideology on all the people. And what's happened over 20 years in Iran is that so many of those scholars who were kind of young and revolutionary and ideological in the early 1980s got older and wiser and saw life in its fullness and saw how the ideology just wasn't working. And they started to interpret things differently, but that what happens in the Iranian system is that they set up a kind of council of scholars that has a sort of veto power and an ability to interpret doctrine with absolute authority. And that's what they did. They set that up as so that they could label certain ideas as heretical or as treasonous to the state, and that's what they've done. I mean, they're trying to rein in this opening of thought that through force, but it's not going to be successful. I mean, you can't do it forever. They're trying, but they're able to do that for a certain time with, you know, support from sections of the military, but it's not going to be successful forever.
Just to clarify, the adjudication that was made, if this distinction is valid, was a secular court, a secular authority that ruled here, or a religious authority?
No, this is it was a religious authority. It was like the High Council of Religious Scholars. But the question is, and the question that everyone else is saying, is who gave you that authority to be the absolute interpreters of the faith? And that's what the rest of the people are questioning. I mean, there are other scholars who are saying, we don't agree with that interpretation, so what, you know, who gave you that power? Well, of course, let's say God gave us that power. But this is the question. You can have a room full of people who claim that God gave you the power, so the key is to have the political system that allows very conflicting beliefs, yet the freedom to articulate those. Can I take
one more? I just want to comment on this gentleman's remark when he said that the Constitution is based on individual rights. I think that's something that Judaism and Islam and non-fundamentalist Christianity have in common, is a concern for the common good, that we're not just individual atoms bouncing around in the universe, but that we form communities and societies. And I think this goes back to your comment about looking for a good public policy.
I wonder if you clear something up for me. You indicated that the problem was things that they corrupted the Sharia and Islamic law. And one of my question is, do you feel that the changing of the old eye for an eye, or cutting the hand off of the thief, for instance, that punishment was actually wrong to come about or to change?
But that's not, they didn't change that. That's not, in fact, the criminal law that the French and the British brought to Asia and Africa was far more severe than anything that existed in the Muslim world. I don't know if you know much about 19th century criminal law and punishments in England, but children could be executed for theft in 19th century England, and there wasn't a minimum amount. So, I mean, it's a fallacy to think that, there's something called Western legal systems that are based simply on, you know, tolerance and mercy. Every legal system has criminal law aspect, and criminal law is not a very pretty thing. The United States still exercises the ultimate corporal punishment, which is execution. It's not a pleasant thing to watch, no matter what form it takes. Now, does that mean that those punishments are always appropriate, or that those punishments need to be continually to be applied in all contexts and all societies? So, for example, we could say that even in the United States, that capital punishment may be appropriate, or we could accept it in theory, but we could say that because of so many problems in society, that we should just ban it because it's too problematic. Any good that's achieved by it is outweighed by the negatives. Same thing with many of these criminal punishments. If you look at the Ottoman Empire, for example, the archives of the Ottoman Empire, which existed for 500 years, the major power in the Muslim world, the archives show that imprisonment was the punishment of choice over corporal punishments in almost all cases. Now, if you go to somewhere in the desert, where not only do they not have prisons, but they don't even have houses, I mean, they're moving from side to side, in those cases, people would continue to administer corporal punishments that could be, you know, administered, finished, and then you take him along with you to the next campsite. So a lot of it has to do with the infrastructure of the people, and in my opinion, it's not a necessary part of Islamic law that a particular kind of punishment must necessarily be applied in all places and all times.
Thank you.